All right. Ask anyone who's been through the heartbreak of infertility, and they'll likely tell you it's something that they wouldn't wish on their worst enemy. Similarly, gay couples who together can't have a child, or single people who long to be parents. You often hear them saying, we'd do anything to have a child. And for some people, the anything they will do includes using a sperm or egg donor and or a surrogate, which on the face of it is a perfect solution for a childless couple or individual to become parents. But have you ever wondered how people conceived using a donor feel about how they come into the world? How those given birth to by a surrogate feel about the woman that carried them? Very often when we talk about egg or sperm donation or surrogacy, it's from a very adult-centred or intended parent-centred focus. It's often in a very, very positive light because, of course, it's the delight and celebration of new life. But how often do we really ask, what about the children? For Talking Point this morning, that's the question that we're asking. What about the children? Is surrogacy, donor conception, ethical? Is it always a good idea? What impact does it have on the children? I'm delighted this morning and very honoured that we are joined by a five-strong panel of people, all of whom are connected to surrogacy and donor conception in some way. First off, Fiona Darroch. Fiona was 51 when she discovered that she was a donor-conceived child. Not only that, but that her mother's gynaecologist, the Durban doctor Norman Tony Walker, who was also incidentally her godfather, was actually the donor and therefore was her biological father. And in fact, what Fiona discovered was that Walker was the donor for at least 100 other families for approximately 14 years. And Fiona believes that she could have in excess of 300 half-brothers and sisters. Fiona is now an advocate for the rights of donor-conceived people, and she joins us via Skype this morning. Offering another perspective is Dakin Parker, whose twin boys are donor-conceived and were carried by a surrogate. After his divorce in 2017, Dakin decided to become a single dad and began his journey in surrogacy in 2019. And in February 2020, his gorgeous boys were delivered using his sperm and an anonymous egg donor and carried by a surrogate. Speaking of surrogates, we're also joined by Lorandia Filion, who has been both an egg donor and a surrogate. And she says it's an honour to be able to help a struggling mom to share in the joys of motherhood. In 2019, she was a surrogate with twins and just last month gave birth to a surrogate baby girl. For a legal perspective on this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by attorney Robin Friedman, whose own child was actually born via surrogate. She runs surrogacy.co.za, and she's going to be able to help us understand some of the legal considerations when it comes to surrogacy and donor conception. And finally, we welcome Tertia Alberton, who many of you will know as the founder of Nurture, which is an egg donor and surrogacy program. Tertia is also a published author, an award-winning blogger, and describes herself as a seasoned infertility veteran and dedicated baby maker. She is also mom to three kids. Welcome to you all. Great to have you with us. Really do appreciate your time with us this morning. So looking forward to this conversation. Fiona, if I could start with you, your story is incredible. At 51, you discovered that you were a donor-conceived child and that your mum's gynaecologist, as I said, Durban doctor, the late Norman Walker, was actually the donor. What emotions did you go through upon that discovery?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it was a roller coaster of emotions, really. One minute it was interesting and exciting, and it was exciting to discover all these donor siblings. The next minute it felt like the world had literally fallen out from underneath me. And it was scary and depressing, and my whole identity fractured. I didn't know who I really was. Every time I looked in the mirror, I didn't really recognize. I was looking for features which, I could recognize, right, so this comes from mum. Like, I always thought I looked like my father who raised me, but obviously I don't. Where does this come from? So it was a process, and it took quite a few years to actually rebuild that identity and to make sense of it.
Walker was the donor for at least 100 families, and you've said that it's possible that you could have in excess of 300 half-brothers and sisters. Have you been able to trace any of them, and what are their thoughts on being donor-conceived?
Yes, I have been able to. So what happened was one of my daughters tested, and she matched with all these people whose names she had never heard of before, and they were matched as close matches. And we followed that up. And then we found all these donor siblings and all these cousins and nephews and nieces. So what we did was we put our DNA out on all the different sites. So we you know, cast as wide a net as possible to try and grow the database, to try and find other people. But of course, South Africa has quite a way to go to catch up with, and you know, the interest in ancestry testing that has taken off in America and the UK and in Australia as well. So we're expecting to get a lot more matches down the track. But every now and then another one will pop up, and we'll have to explain the story and provide all the information. But I don't think we'll ever really know how many there are of us. Perhaps the next generation will be the ones to put the bits of the puzzle together as people get more proficient in learning how to do that. Maybe down the track,
yeah,
we'll have a better idea.
You say that some of your siblings are really angry. What are they angry about?
Well, I think there is a lot to be angry about. First of all, it's a very shocking thing to make a discovery later in life that your parents have lied to you about something as important as paternity. And then to find out that you have all these relatives out there, grandparents who you've never had a chance to meet. My grandparents lived fairly close down the road from where we lived in Durban. Aunts and uncles, cousins who were being raised in, you know, your location, and of course all the brothers and sisters that you never got a chance to grow up with and to meet. And in addition to that, there are things like incomplete or inaccurate medical histories. Now, my dad had a pretty bad medical history. He had a whole bunch of brothers and sisters who died of cancer. One of my aunties died of cancer very young. She had breast cancer. Another one, an uncle, died of pancreatic cancer. My dad had heart disease. And I thought that history, that medical history, was my medical history. But of course it wasn't. You know, we had no genetic connection at all. Every time we went to the doctor, that was the medical history that I would trot out because that was the one I believed. There's so many other things as well. There's, you know, inaccurate records and birth certificates and having all your rights just totally ignored, apart from having your relationship severed preconception, and being expected to be happy about it and grateful for, you know, being born.
Fiona, the voice of donor...
Sorry, the
voice of donor-conceived people is a very, very muted one. We so rarely hear from people like you. Do you think that we romanticise the idea of donor conception and or surrogacy without really fully understanding the impact on people like you?
Absolutely. And I think that has changed. I think that my generation, so I'm 58, nearly 59 now, my generation is the first generation to really step forward and to say, hey, hang on, this is not okay. And I think helped by possibly by eugenics, because we're all produced from doctors and lawyers and university students who were selected as sperm donors. You've got a bunch of people who are bright, well-educated, articulate, and who can see that things need to change for the next generation. Mm-hmm. So this is the group of people who have started to make those changes. You know, you've got Jo Rose, who 10 years ago took her case to the High Court in London and made a case for overturning donor anonymity in the UK. You have filmmakers like Barry Stevens, who's a Canadian filmmaker who's been making documentaries for a long time now about donor conception, and he's just made a brilliant one where I think it's called The World's Biggest Family, where he has filmed reunions with his donor siblings and traced his story. And he has about 1,000 donor siblings. So, you know, my little group is quite a small group, really,
Fiona,
compared
to some
of these huge groups that are out
Indeed. I want to bring in at this point, if I may, another perspective, which will come from Dakin Parker. His twin boys, are donor conceived and were carried by a surrogate. Dakin, a very good morning to you. Lovely to have you with us. Thanks so much for making time. Your boys were born in January 2020, before the world went mad. And they were conceived using an anonymous donor and a surrogate. And obviously, as a single gay man, your options in terms of having children were always going to be quite limited. They would, I guess, would be adoption or surrogacy and egg donation. Why did you go for egg donation, but why surrogacy?
Hi, Sarah Jane.
Hi,
everybody. Hi. So I had explored from the moment I actually started coming to terms with my own sexuality. So 20 years ago, this journey started for me because it was one of the most depressing aspects that I had to come to terms with in and of myself, was the fact that, you know, at that point, at least, there was no possible way of becoming a parent. I come from a large family. Family is very important to us. I'm the only son of four kids. And so at the very beginning of kind of my adult journey, that was just off the table entirely. And that was sad. That was very, very sad for me. I lived overseas for a while. I joined groups of people wanting to become parents that explored different avenues to do it. Fostering is one of them for sure. Adoption was another. And when I was married, we were actually going to adopt an older sibling pair. It felt like the right thing for us to do as a couple. But after my divorce, I just realized that as a single parent, that I specifically personally wasn't wired to be a good adoptive parent for a whole host of reasons. And so I also actually explored platonic co-parenting with a girlfriend of mine, a straight girlfriend of mine who was also divorced and also wanted to have kids. So we traveled a whole bunch of different paths. And got to go, in other words, the start line on a couple of them, and it just didn't feel right. So I actually took a year off after my divorce. I traveled from Cape Town to Northern Uganda and back all by myself. And on that journey, investigating myself and my beliefs and the world around me in a deeply personal way, I came to the decision that surrogacy was really something that I wanted to do, that I wanted to pursue for me. It felt right. The process was quite a spiritual journey for me as well. And I actually feel like in that journey interacted with the two spirits of who eventually would become, you know, my two sons. And when I got back to South Africa at the beginning of 2019, I started my research and trying to find out what was possible. I knew nothing of it. I didn't know the law. I didn't know what lay in wait. But a year and 10 days after my first meeting, my boys were born. And it's been quite a magical experience from even before then, but certainly from then onwards.
Dakin, can I ask you mentioned your research there. And in that research, how much of that research did you do around finding out how donor-conceived people feel about being donor-conceived and how children carried by a surrogate feel about that? Was that part of your research?
Absolutely. So when I lived overseas, I have friends who have kids who are now in their late teens who were donor conceived and born through surrogacy. I also, in fact, and this I was thinking this morning about this interview, one of the very first interactions that I had with donor-conceived kids were a beautifully adjusted 7 and 9-year-old boy and girl, twin of a lesbian couple down in Cape Town when I was still in my early 20s. I was a waiter at a Spur restaurant, and these kids and their two moms came and visited me. And they were, I just remember, and I mean, this is 20 years ago, being struck by how well-adjusted, they were so polite, they were so amazing, they were great kids. So the two of them started my journey, but most recently, obviously, with friends and friends of friends and family of friends, I spoke to surrogates, I spoke to social workers, I spoke to my friend's son overseas, just to try to understand. The biggest thing that a piece of information I was getting in that research was that it's going to be very dependent on the temperament of the child. So you know, I've obviously thought a lot about what my answers are going to be to the boys when they start asking questions. I actually last the year before they were born, my Christmas gift to my entire family was a fairy tale that I'd written about the shape of family. And in the back of the fairy tale were certain notes on, you know, how I would like us to all speak about this. And it was all about being candid, being honest, having the answers on the ready when the kids ask the difficult questions. Because I do believe it is important to be very honest up front. I mean, I think in my case, it's very difficult to not be honest because I just look, my family looks different to some of the families that my boys will be involved with.
One of those difficult questions, and I should just say, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning on Talking Point about the ethics, the considerations when it comes to donor conception and surrogacy. We've got a host of guests still waiting in the wings who we will get to. We will take a short break at 5:30 for headlines. But one of the difficult questions, Dakin Parker has got two children, two twin boys, born in January 2020, using an anonymous donor and a surrogate. One of those difficult questions that you are likely to be asked, I would imagine, by your boys is why was the donor anonymous?
Yeah. And the very simple question to that is that's the law at the time. I will support their desire, if they so desire, to find out who that was. But at the moment, that's what the law says.
That the donor has to be anonymous.
Yes.
Sure. I think we will bring Fiona Darroch back in. And of course, we will come back to you, Dakin, because there's so many questions that I have to ask you about that process and about your boys, too. But we're also going to be joined by Lorandia Filion, who is also she's an egg donor, but also a surrogate. She's just given birth last month to a little girl. We're also going to be meeting Robin Friedman, who's a lawyer who can provide us with and Dakin just spoke about the context of the legality and what the law says around donor conception and surrogacy. And Robin will be able to provide a context in that regard. And also, we welcome back to Cape Talker a friend of the station, Tertia Alberton, who is the founder of Nurture, which is an egg donor and surrogacy program. And I'd love to hear your thoughts if you're tuned in this morning. What do you think? What are the ethics around this? Some of the issues that Fiona has mentioned include people who are donor conceived having enormous issues around identity. Who do I look like? What I want to know my roots, piecing together what could be in some cases an enormous family. You know, as an adopted person myself, having discovered my siblings, and there's four of them later in life, I can say that it was absolutely devastating. It was to have to regroup and yes, it was wonderful to meet them, but I felt denied an entire childhood with people who are families. And it sounds to me, a lot of the issues that Fiona is speaking about are very familiar to me as an adopted person. We feel unheard, we feel denied our true family. Many have identity issues, but I also think, and this is just my opinion, a lot of it is about how the conversations are had. And Dakin just explained to us there, you know, he has got a very clear way of how he wants his boy's story to be spoken about within his family. It's 25 minutes to 9:00, where we are focusing on the considerations, the ethics around donor conception and surrogacy. We started off the conversation hearing it from Fiona Darroch, who was 51 when she discovered that the man she thought was her father wasn't her father. In fact, she was the product of sperm donation by her mother's gynecologist, who was her biological father. And in discovering this, she also discovered that she's potentially got upwards of 200 half-brothers and sisters. And Fiona's spoken about, she's now an advocate for donor-conceived people, and has spoken about some of the issues that come up for people conceived in this way around identity. She spoke about issues, medical records, medical history, and sort of having to piece together the jigsaw of one's life. And obviously, there will be different factors that apply for all different families who have a connection to donor conception and surrogacy. We also met Dakin Parker, who is dad to two, I'm sure, fairly rambunctious twins, having been born in January 2020. Dakin used an anonymous egg donor, which is the law in South Africa, and a surrogate, and has spoken to us about his decision. He said it was, you know, it was a long process for him to decide that donor conception and surrogacy was the way forward for him as a single gay man. He said that part of his coming to terms with his sexuality was the devastation of realising that he wouldn't be able to have children in a quote-unquote traditional way. I want to welcome to the show now somebody who can offer yet another perspective, Lerandia Viljoen, who has been both a surrogate and an egg donor. Very good morning to you, Lerandia. Lovely to have you on the show. You've also just given birth to, you initially gave birth to twins, I understand, as a surrogate, and then you've just given birth to a little girl in May.
Morning, yes, I did.
Gosh, wow. Okay, fantastic. Listen, you've been both a surrogate and you've been an egg donor. Why? Why did you want to do this?
Well, a quick background. In my family, on my mom and dad's side, there was infertility problems with uncles and aunts. And from a little girl age, I always said I want to make a difference or to help somebody in that way, but I never knew exactly where, when, and how. And as I grow older, and after my firstborn, we also, me and my husband, actually also had this whole thing that we couldn't conceive our second child. And we also had this whole learning about what if we, there's no ifs actually, if we can't get another one the natural way, our way, infertility and all of that. And after we did get pregnant with our second child, I said, this is that we have to help another couple or just help society of giving life or making the whole family complete. Because I know of a mommy and daddy's perspective that you do long for a child, even if you already have one, even if you dreamt of one, two, or three children, you always want your family complete. And that is how I came to the whole, I'm going to change somebody or a mommy and daddy's life in surrogacy and egg donation.
I hear what you're saying, and what you're saying, it sounds wonderful. It sounds altruistic. It sounds very, very selfless. But also what I'm hearing, Lerandia, is you talking about mummy and daddy. I'm not hearing you talking about the child. So when you listen to Fiona talking about some of the issues that her that people like her, donor-conceived people, come up with, how do you feel about that? Because the current situation in South Africa is that those who, and obviously donation, egg donation is a very different beast to surrogacy, which we can talk about in a second. But in terms of egg donation, that is another human being. That's a human being that is your, I want to say, your child out there. And from a biological perspective, that is your child. So how does it make you feel when you hear people like Fiona say, it's actually not all rainbows and unicorns for us?
It's sad to hear that. I'm going to be honest with you. It's really sad to hear from a egg donation baby, or sperm baby, if I can put it like that. Sorry. but it's sad. By law, we're not allowed to know who the couple is, and which I do respect. But if the mom and dad wants to tell the child where they came or how it came about, it's fine. I think the fertility, I know the fertility hospitals and stuff, and even the lawyers do have our numbers. And if the child decides they want to get involved or get a hold of us, I do believe they will give that to them. Look, I don't have any hands-on experience except with just giving my eggs with egg donations due to the fact of the whole law perspective side of it. And I do respect that. So on that, I do feel sorry for them. And to think about it that way, you're basically giving half away of your life for another life. But still, it wouldn't change a bit if I can complete a family. If that child makes that mommy and daddy's heart and house complete, I'm happy for them. But it's their parents' decision to tell them what all the bits and pieces. We can't do it.
So I'm going to throw out a question to you and also to Dakin, if I may. I'm playing devil's advocate here. Does a person's desire to be a parent, and I am a parent, and I can't imagine my life without my daughter, and I'm speaking from somebody who is almost painfully fertile. I think my other half just looked across the room at me and I felt pregnant. But I know, you know, my own mother, my adoptive mum, suffered tremendously through the pain of infertility. So I'm not completely alien to that. But I will ask you, does a person's desire to be a parent supersede a child's right to an identity and to know their biological family? I'll ask you and also to Dakin.
Shoot, that is a... Where's Robin? Can she help me?
But from a legal perspective, from a moral perspective, from an ethical point of view.
Like if I would have a child in that way, I would probably tell her when they're big enough and understanding enough to tell them the truth. But I think at that moment, you as a parent, do what you think is right. Mm-hmm. If there is no other way out or to get a child or even adopt a child. I know adoption is not part of the conversation, but even adopt a child.
Similar parallels for sure.
Yeah. At the end of the day, you have to tell the child the whole story. And if you don't tell the story to them, it's your fault as a parent that you basically lived a lie, if I can put it like that. And I don't mean it wrong. If I have to get a child or had a child in the fertility way through egg donation or sperm donation, I would have told them from the word go and on the age where they can understand, listen, this is the story, but we love you as you are and we love you and we want to give you what we think you need.
Miranda, just one final question because I must get to our other guests. If the children who were conceived using your eggs wanted to communicate with you, how would you feel about that?
I will be all open to it. Mm, okay. If they want to learn or get to know me, I will do that with love.
Okay.
I don't have a problem.
Yeah. Dakin, I just want to pose the same question to you if I can bring you back into the conversation. Dakin Parker is the father to two glorious twin boys who were born in January 2020. He used your own sperm, an egg donor and a surrogate, right? I've got that correct. Yes. I'm going to pose the same question to you. Does a person's desire to be a parent supersede a child's right to their identity and to know their biological family?
Sarah Jane, I don't think that those are two mutually exclusive propositions.
Got it.
Even in a surrogacy or kind of like, you know, the way that my family came up, I went through a huge process, much more due diligence than I think any heteronormative family ever needs to go through before they can have a child. I was deeply curious about how to do this. And so, and I've also made the decision that they will always know the truth. I do accept that biological origin is a very foundational aspect of identity, but there are a lot of other aspects of identity that could, without even desiring it, be squashed or channeled or changed in other family setups. Like I denied a huge part of my identity for the first 20 years of my life because I was in an environment that didn't embrace a child being able to say, I feel different. And that's, I came from, I had the most quote unquote normal looking family that there was.
Yeah.
So I think it also comes down to a person's fundamental belief on the role of parenting. Am I supposed to create the absolutely perfect environment for 18 years where another human being comes out with no scratches, no bruises whatsoever?
Because if that's the expectation, we're all screwed.
Well, exactly. And then there's the spiritual aspect of my specific journey, which always feels weird to talk about out loud, but makes complete sense in my own head. And I believe on a spiritual plane, this was destined. And that my boys also did choose this existence for themselves. But yeah, that's, I think that's kind of a whole different conversation.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. I want to move now to Tertia Alberton, founder of Nurture, an egg donor and surrogacy program. Tertia, it feels like about 10 years since we last spoke, but it's not that long. You've helped a lot of people become parents, Tertia, but there is another side to this, as we've heard from Fiona, which is that some of these children that you have had a finger or hand in, not literally, in bringing into the world, who are so desperately wanted by their parents, so desperately loved by their parents, grow up and some experience issues around how they come into the world. Does that ever make you ponder whether surrogacy and donor conception is ethical, a good idea?
Hi, Sarah. Lovely to chat to you again. You know, we operate within the South African environment in a really ethical, legal, structured way. We are, of course, bound by the law that says egg donation has to be done anonymously unless you use what is called a known donor. So that's always an option that we need to bring into the conversation. So if you can use your sister or your friend, and then it's a different process to what our guests have gone through.
Indeed, yeah.
You know, the bottom line is, as you know, our earlier guest said, the two are not mutually exclusive, the desire to be a parent and the rights of the child. They can both be looked after. It's up to the parents to decide whether they're going to tell their child whether they were conceived by a donor. And most of the parents do.
Do they?
They do. They do. Yeah. You know, in this world of DNA testing and the ancestry stuff, it's quite a difficult secret to keep if you want to keep it a secret. But most people do tell. And all the theory says that you tell early and you tell often.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
You say that most people do, which means that there are some people who don't. Do they disclose to you whether they will or they won't? No.
No, they don't disclose to us.
Do you offer advice in that regard? Do you say, listen, best practices, and the experts say, right, okay.
Yes, yeah, we do. Yeah. We do say it's better to tell. It's always better to tell. Secrets are not good.
No.
But it's up to their choice. And some people don't tell for various reasons. It could be religious. It could be cultural. It could be family, you know.
How important then, Tertia, is it that we hear voices like Fiona's, that we, and not only do we hear them, but that we elevate them and that we centre them in the process of talking about donor conception and although it wasn't Fiona's story, surrogacy? And what can organisations like yours do to elevate the voices of donor-conceived people?
I mean, I think it's incredibly important that the voices like Fiona's are heard. I just want to add quickly that according to law, there may not be more than 6 babies from a donor, whether egg or sperm. So the 300 children out there is not going to happen. Only a maximum of 6 babies may be born through
it's
donor
still
conception.
Six, from though. I absolutely appreciate what you're saying, and we all kind of take a sharp intake of breath when we hear she's got 250. But even I've only got 4 half siblings, and that's really that's tough. It's still 4 people who look like me, but I had to get to know when I was in my late 30s.
Yes, I know. They're getting to know. I mean, finding out even in your teens is pretty devastating.
Yeah.
So that's why it's so important to have a conversation with the child right from the beginning.
Yeah, got it.
And to share. And it's not something to be ashamed of. It's not a second best. It's not a secret. It's a wonderful story of being a donor-conceived child. You know, there were everybody in that process desperately wanted this child to be born.
But is, and I'm again, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. In fact, I want to bring Fiona back in, if I may.
Yes,
sure. When you say, Tertia, and I know that you say it with absolutely 100% the best will in the world, and you do what you do because you're a lovely human and you want people to be happy. But when you frame it in that way and say it's a lovely story, I just wonder if for you it's a lovely story and for the parents it's a lovely story, but it sounds quite a prescriptive way to speak about it, because for the child that who may have their own issues, and the analogy that I'm drawing again as an adopted person is that often people say to me, oh, but it's a lovely story, your mummy and daddy wanted you so much. Yes, they did, and that's wonderful, and they loved us deeply, but it doesn't take away from my own lived experience of feelings of having been you know, rejected by a biological mother, the attachment issues of being carried by somebody and then not. So I want to bring in this point. I want to bring in Fiona. Fiona, what are your thoughts? When Tertia says it's a lovely story, what would be your response to that?
I would say it's a violation of children's rights. I'd say that 31 years ago, the UN had a congress where they came together with all the different countries and they agreed on what the rights were going to be, and they set out the convention. And I think that if you read Article 8, you'll find out that it is our right to know who our parents are, where we come from, and to have relationships. I think that's what Tertia's actually failing to see, that it's all very well to tell the story and, you know, Dakin's got his story and it's scripted beautifully, but it fails to recognise that just as it's important for the recipient parents to have relationships with the biologically connected child, whether it's a genetically connected or they've carried it themselves and they've got an egg donor, it's important to them. It's equally as important to us to have relationships, and you're not going to have opportunities to have relationships just by telling early and often. You actually have to create opportunities to be able to have shared experiences. You have to, you know, be able to know, yeah, that's my biological grandmother and this is the story of the family, but also to have experiences growing up with your cousins, because believe me, it is incredibly hard as an adult to start building those relationships. So while I have complete empathy for people who are battling infertility, whether it's medical or social infertility, and I can really understand their pain and empathize with them, what they're actually doing by solving this, by having a baby through donation and severing the relationships that that child is going to have with their genetic family, is actually passing the burden onto that child to sort out this problem, as with adoptees, to find the bits of the missing jigsaw puzzle and to put it all together. And it's very hard.
I want to go to Robin Friedman, who's a lawyer and herself an intended parent. Her son was born via surrogate. But before I do that, I just want to read something from a woman named Jessica Kern, who's a product of traditional surrogacy, which I don't believe, and Robin will correct me, is legal here. Traditional surrogacy, my understanding, is the donor egg. The egg donor is the same person who carries the child. She wrote this: as a product of surrogacy, I can tell you firsthand what we children of donor conception go through. Children of surrogacy, just like children of a traditional adoption, deal with all the traumas that go along with adoption. We want to know where we came from. We want to know who our biological mothers are. We want to know who gave birth to us and what they are like. We're curious about the family and other siblings we may have. As a product of surrogacy, when I express this viewpoint to others, I'm told, look how much your parents wanted you. They planned, they saved to have you. You should be grateful and thankful for them. But at the end of the day, the adults were looking out for themselves and what they needed and they wanted. Listen, that's one person's experience, but she does represent a number of donor-conceived people and surrogate children born by surrogate who feel that way. And I don't think it's necessarily helpful to dismiss her as just one person, because that person's experiences are valid. Robin, welcome to you. It seems like it would be potentially a legal minefield if we look 20 years in the future, when suddenly you have potentially a lot of donor-conceived children coming back and saying, hold on a minute, this is wrong. I want to have access to my records. Welcome. What does the law say about anonymous donations? And also, do people get paid for those?
Okay, so there's a whole change happening universally with regards to anonymous donors. The thinking now is, because children have come forward and they do want to have access to their biological origins, that the world should start shifting and the law should start shifting in time, and that donor-conceived children should be given complete access to the information of their biological origins. Now, South Africa is not at the forefront of this yet. I think it's going to take time. There have been hundreds and hundreds and possibly thousands and thousands of donor-conceived children in South Africa. They will never know their origins other than what is given to them by the egg donation agency like Nurture.
they will never know the identities of the parents. But I'm sure in the future, and there's a lot of evolution happening in our law, in the next few years, it is going to change, and I do believe that this change is going to bring about the end of anonymous egg and sperm donors, because it has been shown universally that from a psychological perspective, it is better for the child to know.
Go ahead, Robin.
The one thing that I disagree with Fiona about is I understand the frustration, but you must, an egg donor is not a parent. An egg donor's father is not a grandparent. An egg donor's mother is not a grandmother. A parent is the parent who brings up and raises this child. So I have a child, I have a family that is pretty unique because I have two girls that are adopted, two different birth mothers, and I have a surrogate son who's 11 years old who is egg donor conceived but my husband's sperm. So I can tell you, you know, my personal experiences from all three different aspects. And
but it's not your personal experience though, Robin. With the greatest respect, there's a connection there, but you aren't your adopted daughters and you aren't your donor conceived son. So I totally get, yes, when I talk about my mum, I talk about the mother that raised me, you know, my adoptive mum. But there's still a connection to the woman in whom I was carried for 9 months. When I talk about my dad, yes, my dad who I grew up with in the UK, but I still have a father who lives in Johannesburg who, when he smiles, has the same gap between his teeth that I have. You see?
That's right. So I'm not dismissing, what I'm trying to get at is that I'm telling the story through the eyes of my children, not through my eyes. So I adopted an approach from birth where I was completely open and honest, and I consistently used the word, you're an egg donor, surrogacy conceived child, so that it would never be a foreign concept and it would never be an uncomfortable or a shameful term for them, or that you're my beautiful adopted child. And I have regular conversations with my girls about the adoptive parents and the whys that why the adoptive mom gave them up and when are we going to meet. And I think the one anchor that my girls have is that at some point in time when they're 18 or when they're ready, that I will go with them to meet their adoptive mothers, but they have absolutely all the information available to them. I have shown them everything. I've shown them photos of the birth parents. For my son who's egg donor conceived, I don't have access to that much information, but I have given him absolutely everything that I know. He unfortunately will never know the true identity of his biological connection, but my girls will know that. And I think with this transparency and this consistent talking through and the openness and the honesty and the debating around these concepts ultimately leads to the children being very content because their questions are answered to a large extent. There will always be a little bit of curiosity, but we will deal with the curiosity when they're 18 and we can meet the birth mothers.
One final question that I have to ask, because lots of people have been messaging in. If I provide an egg, and we've literally got a minute, so I'm going to have to rely on your very quick legal brain. If I provide an egg, my husband provides the sperm and we use a surrogate. Who are the legal parents of that child, Robin?
Sorry, say again. If you
who, my egg, my husband's sperm and a surrogate. Who's the legal parents?
The parents? We have in South Africa what we call preconception birth orders. Before
you're going to have to answer in literally 30 seconds.
The parents are the parents who the intended parents will be the parents in legal terms.
The biological parents.
Well, it's not only if you are the commissioning parents and you commission a surrogacy and you've used an egg donor in that process, you will still be the parent, irrespective of the egg donor.
Got it. Okay. Oh, Robin, it's such an interesting conversation to unpack. I wish we had longer. It has been an absolutely fascinating hour. My thanks so much to all five of our guests who have shared honestly and candidly on what can be a very, very difficult topic. We appreciate your time. It's 9 o'clock.